bring this meeting of the House State Affairs to order. It is 8:08, and today we have before us three items. The first one is going to be House Bill 186, and we're happy to have Senator Seekins back with us. Today we have President Representative Elkins, Representative Ramirez, Representative Gardner, Representative Gatto, and Chair Seaton. And the order of business will be 186, House Bill 347, and then 328. We didn't get our public testimony in the other day. I'll open public hearing on House Bill 186. Is there anyone online that wishes to testify on House Bill 186, or Senate Bill 186? Better get this right. No one online. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 186? Seeing no one there, I will close testimony. I'll bring the committee's attention to we have testimony submitted by Richard Hahn on February 7th. That was distributed on your desk. And we have before us, Senator Seekins, before we go further with discussion on the bill, would you like to make any further information on it? I guess I had related to you that the committee would like to see some cases. We had talked about the use of this is to get somebody in the executive branch and prevent their advancement. And so we were looking for some cases where this had been filed and made public disclosure. And if those have been publicly disclosed, we should be able to find them. Were you able to find any of those for us?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator Ralph Seekins, Senate District D, which is the Denali Borough and the outskirts of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The last year, the Attorney General's office, the lady who was that we relied on heavily for testimony, has retired. She left the borough and went to work for another political organization, and so we were unable to convince her that she should come back and testify on this particular bill for other reasons. And the person who is there now is almost brand new on the job and was very reluctant to try to dig into files to provide me with names and circumstances for fear violating some of the confidentiality provisions of the ethics law. However, I can tell you, and I can provide off the record, and we started to look back, some of the testimony that Barbara Ritchie gave us where she says it's not been uncommon. In fact, it was fairly common for ethics complaints to be brought against someone just to get at them. I think that's the correct quote. It's if it's not exact, it's a pretty close paraphrase.
And then, Senator Seekins, were then those released publicly? Yeah, I mean, there was
in some cases they were made public. It didn't get a press release. What it got was passed around in the inside of the organization to blacken someone's eye, so to speak, at that point. Now, the biggest public one that anyone points to was the most recent one that we talked about last time, and that was the one that was brought against, at first allegedly brought against, former Commissioner Joel Gilbertson.
Right. Now, we discussed that in some detail. The question is, though, that wouldn't have been released for stopping his advancement in the executive branch to another, which was the case that we were talking about. So
you're correct. And I was not able to get somebody to provide me the direct circumstances, only just to the point that it had been used for that purpose. And one other thing, Mr. Chairman, is that I've asked, I talked to you and then I had my staff person hand out to you, just for your information, because we talked about how complex the process is and how difficult it is to follow. It's actually easier to follow this process in the Executive Act than it is in the Legislative Act. The Legislative Act is very difficult to follow. But for your purposes, we handed out a flow chart of what happens in an ethics complaint when it's brought. And it can be brought several different ways. One is if the Attorney General, in investigating something else, determines that there's an ethics complaint, what do they do? The complaint then is referred directly to the Personnel Board if the Attorney General determines that it's been an ethics complaint. And then on the right-hand upper side, you see the path that starts when another individual initiates that complaint. It has to be in writing. It has to be signed under oath, clearly detail the alleged violation. And then it goes down the chain. And what we talked about, where in that chain does it become public? And I would refer you to the second page at step number 11. Does the investigation result in a finding of probable cause? Yes. Then at section 12, the AG serves a copy of the accusation on the subject, setting out the alleged violation. All proceedings are now open to the public. And there's a lot that goes on after that. As you can see, there are 24 steps in this process. But that's the point, just so that everyone is very clear where that is, because that question, I tried to relay it orally, but I think visually may help all of us. I know I'm a very visual person, and so that you understand. And you can see the steps that take place there. And these steps are pretty logical and can be clearly followed in the statute on the ethics bill. But as you know, the way we draft bills, you don't see the entire bill. You just see those sections that we're proposing to amend. And this, I think, could be helpful to all of you. So, I know it was to me. So I did want to bring that. Other than that, I know you have some other amendments that you want to look at, and I would be more than happy to make comments or answer any questions on those. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate that. Representative Gardner, did you have a question?
When the time comes for the speaker, yes.
Okay. Did you have a question for Senator Seekins at this point in time or when we're going through amendment?
This is a good time.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
You've described a complicated process of addressing ethical complaints, and yeah, it is. It has a lot of steps and is fairly complicated. But for the average person who's not used to reading legislation, who doesn't know the ins and outs of when and what can be done, do you think a penalty for disclosure would have a chilling effect on people who have a legitimate concern for good government and would like to file a complaint?
That's a good question, Representative Gardner. Thank you, Ms. Chair. My belief comes down to a number of things. And as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, one of the hardest things that I work on and try to do is to write the law so that the average person understands it. There are many times when I get in trouble with the drafters because they say, well, knowingly is inferred. And I say, but the average person reading it doesn't know that knowingly is inferred. I mean, to the lawyer, yes, but we're not writing the law all the time, I believe, for the benefit of the lawyer. It should be clear to the person who is trying to interpret the law at their level. So what I believe is that when someone gets involved in the public process, that it should be very clearly explained to them at the outset as to what the process is and what the law requires, both of them and of the person that they're making the complaint against. Current law in the state says that it's a violation of the Ethics Act, whether it's the Executive Ethics Act or it's the Legislative Ethics Act. It's a violation of the Ethics Act to break confidentiality prior to a finding of probable cause. So if a person does that knowingly, They have broken the Ethics Act, the very act that they're using to point out someone else's unethical behavior. Now, if we condone breaking the Ethics Act on one person's side of the page and not the other, the law is hypocritical. And I don't think that's the intent of any of us that are in the legislature. Our laws should be clear, they should be fair, and they should be enforced. So our choices as legislators, as I see it, and I really thank you for asking this question because I have searched this in my own heart to try to find the right answer. Because none of us want someone who is either in the legislative or administrative branches to be able to escape after acting unethically. We want the scoundrel brought to justice. So I've been very clear in trying to draft this. So, and I'm a little clumsy sometimes, and I hope you will forgive me for that. And that's why this committee process is so good, because we can redraft something until it comes out the other end of the tube looking the way we hoped it would in the first place. I believe the person who knowingly and intentionally makes public or causes to be made public should pay a penalty for doing so, but not someone who unintentionally or tells their spouse or their confidant, but someone who has the intent to knowingly and intentionally give a black eye in the, get that 24-hour media cycle as the double whammy, not just the investigation. So we have two choices. Either take the confidentiality requirement totally out of the law, or have a meaningful penalty if someone knowingly and intentionally breaks the law. And that's what someone does. They break the very ethics law they're using to report by knowingly and intentionally making it public. Those are our choices, I believe. And that's, as for the chilling effect, I believe that when someone becomes part of the process, that they should live up to the requirements of the process. It is a serious blow to someone to accuse them of an ethics violation. It should be taken seriously. It should not be done lightly, and it should not be done with the intent of inflicting that second blow, but to get to the bottom of it and to bring that person to justice. If we call allowing someone to break the ethics law chilling, I don't want them to be able to break the ethics law. I either want that out of the law or to make knowingly, intentionally disclosing that publicly for that second blow to be a meaningful penalty, whatever that may be. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to recognize I failed to earlier when Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, and I believe also Representative Ramirez joined us.
I was on time this morning, Mr. Chair.
Oh, maybe I did recognize you then, because I wonder, Representative Gardner. Or
thank is that? You. Yes, in follow-up, there's a big distinction between the average citizen who's following and attempting to participate in government and those of us who have stepped forward to run for office or accept positions in the administration. I mean, we know that we have to file APARC reports, we have to detail where our income comes from, we have to justify how we spend campaign funds, we have to open our lives rightly to public scrutiny. Absolutely. But for the average citizen, it's a different matter. So my question for you is, when a complaint is filed, and it has to be in writing, signed under oath, aside from your proposed penalties, what would be the consequences to somebody who signs something under oath that is knowingly false or malicious? Or
that is a different, that's a different subject altogether. Someone who knows that it's that it's a unrighteous complaint, has broken another section of the law, and there should be a penalty for that, and there is. And I guess the question there is very one clearly, again, in did they knowingly, again, that word knowingly comes up all the time, mens rea, as they call it in the law. I think I'm not a lawyer, but it's been brought to my attention many times by lawyers. That, and I have a son who's a lawyer, so, you know, he's brighter than his dad. It must be in writing, sign under oath, and clearly detail the alleged violation. And again, it's knowingly and alleged. I think someone has a responsibility to turn someone in when they see an ethical violation. But we should make it very clear when they file the complaint what their responsibilities are, that it is a serious violation, that that should not be brought lightly, and that they should be a participant in the process to bring the person to justice. And so I think the very form itself needs to be very clear as to what their responsibilities are by doing so. And there's two things there. You're saying if you're bringing it and you know it isn't true, that's one violation. If you knowingly and intentionally make it public to get the second blow, that's a different violation, totally separate, and they shouldn't be confused. And I think that you
thank you.
I shouldn't be able to do that to anybody.
Okay. Representative Goddard.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. In support, I'm going to be opposed to you and support you depending on what the facts are, but in our packet is a letter from an individual, which, of course, I won't identify. But he makes some statements that just are red flags. He says, where legislators are told how to vote. And so if this person truly believes that legislators are told how to vote, she is in serious error. Further, he goes on to say, paid by special interest to sponsor or block legislation. So what we have here is an individual, not only is he calling us unethical, but is making a couple of statements here that, in my mind, are simply false. And then the question I have is, to myself, as well as to you, is it important for me to allow him to make statements like that in print to a media? And I personally think it is.
I do too.
I really fault the media more than I fault the individual for picking up a story for which they have no factual information but could get it simply by making a request to say, hey, Mr. Gatto, have you ever been told how to vote? Ever, even by your wife or by anyone you know? And have you ever been paid to sponsor legislation or block legislation? Never asked, but they'd be happy to run the story. And so I have this serious concern about the media more than I have about the individual. And if we were to think about penalties following the decision tree that you've provided here, gosh, would I love to go after the media for carrying a story for which they had absolutely no basics except somebody said. It's no different than if they heard it third-handed. But I'm willing to protect the individual who wrote this and who made these statements from saying anything he wants. It's not a concern of mine to stop a person from making a statement because that's a First Amendment right, as long as they're not inciting a riot or causing damage or injury or something to an individual. That's the problem I have essentially with ethics legislation is, A, are we going after, are we even looking at the right person? And B, do I want to penalize a person for exercising what in their mind and in my mind also is a reasonable thing to do, and that is make accusations if you want to. You make enough of them, cry wolf enough times, and nobody's paying attention anymore. And we certainly have people in the community who have names that we all can identify that love to simply get their name in the paper, and this is a good way to do it. So I guess it's not a question for you, except that I think it weighs heavily on how we handle ethics legislation when it specifically looks at not the violator, which is the media, but the individual who simply made a statement.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, there are three things that come to mind. There are always going to be hand grenade throwers in life. That's the person who comes to the door, says, "Here, you guys have a problem," throws the hand grenade in and closes the door from the outside and has no solution to what they perceive to be a problem. Just want to blow it up from the outside. Secondly, I was in a discussion once at the Air Force War College with a guy named Ralph Biglighter, I think his name was. He was a former syndicated news columnist, reporter, and it became very clear to me in the discussion that he was portraying news today as entertainment, not necessarily as journalism. And sometimes we could always look at news stories in which we have been involved and say it's more than entertainment, it's a joke, because it was so goofed up, so backwards from what the reality that we perceived it to be. But yeah, I think sometimes people have free rein, and I don't, when we were elected, Representative Gatto, there was this transformation that took place. We took a transformation from being solid citizens in our community to becoming scoundrels in the eyes of many of the people in the public. And we have to live with that and understand that some folks just don't really understand the process.
Any other? Okay, seeing none, let's look at the bill. We have before us some amendments. We have the, let's just go through this. There's several other committee members that have amendments as well. I think we'll just go through this first packet. If there are other ones to substitute in there, we'll do them at the time. They deal with the same that are all drafted. The First Amendment, label amendment number one, is the one that says blind trust on it. It's labeled X.5 in the upper right-hand corner, has a fax across the top, so we'll label that amendment number one.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, and I'll offer yes, to Representative Grimberg.
I'll object for the purpose of discussion.
Yes, Representative
Grimberg. I've handed out a copy of the reference statute on line 8, and that is the underlying blind trusts statute. I find some things troubling in that statute, and I'm not sure exactly how we cure that here. But first of all, let me tell you what I see the problems in the underlying statute to be. They mainly relate to subsection B4, and there are two important loopholes there. The word confidential is vague, and it doesn't necessarily mean shall not be disclosed. I think that's the intent. I'll come back to that. Also, from the trustor is a loophole, because the trustee can simply tell the trustor's wife, business associate, attorney, accountant, somebody else. And that is a serious loophole in that statute, and so is the word confidentiality. It's beyond the scope of this bill to deal with 3950.040, but I think that I'm going to offer, Mr. Chair, a conceptual amendment to your amendment.
Representative Grimberg.
Have you moved the amendment yet?
What's that?
Have you moved the amendment?
Yes, I moved the amendment.
And I objected. And it would be to have a provision in this new AS 3952.415 to state, and I'll have to draft this or get the legal counsel work with the staff on it, that as used in this section, which is 3952.415, the following terms in AS 3950.040B4 shall have the following meanings. One, confidentiality shall mean not be disclosed. And number two, trustor shall include not only the trustor herself, but all the trust, any trustor's agents or immediate family. So that we tighten it, at least for the purposes of this bill. And I can write that out, Mr. Chair, but I think we need to tighten those two terms for the purposes of this bill anyway.
And so you're offering that as an amendment, a conceptual amendment to the bill?
Conceptual amendment to the amendment.
Okay, and that is modifying those, or
confidential,
defining those two terms as
just
confidential.
Once again, means shall not be disclosed. And number two, trustor shall include not only the trustor, I'm going to say himself, whatever the term is, that comma, but also the trustor's agents, business associates, and immediate family. And that is my amendment to the amendment.
Do I hear an objection to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to get a clarification on the first point you raised. I didn't understand that.
Well, the term shall be confidential is vague. I think it means shall not be disclosed, but I want it to be put in there crystal clear. You can't tell them.
And Representative Grunberg, so for clarification, that is meaning that the management firm or the management agency would be prevented from disclosing to the person that deposits the assets what any of those assets are.
Or what happens to them, yes.
Yeah.
That makes it blind, as opposed to just a trust.
Mm-hmm. And speaking to that amendment, that was the entire intent of the blind trust. So I think that helps that. Although I think judiciary will probably be...
This doesn't go to judiciary. That's the problem.
Oh, it doesn't go to judiciary.
Maybe it ought to, but it doesn't.
Representative Lynn, did that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah. Are there any objections to the amendment to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment to the amendment is adopted. So we have before us amendment number one.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask what one?
Yes,
is,
Representative Seekins, or Senator Seekins.
X.5, your number one?
Yes, X.5 is number one.
Could I ask you a question?
Yes, Representative Senator Seekins.
Yeah, my wife still calls me Ralph, but it's the... on line 9, I just want have a question that, and I know you've looked at this, I'm sure, but of that amendment where the trust must be divested promptly of assets originally transferred. Have you looked at the tax ramifications of that? Who someone who has a large portfolio, let's say, someone had a. I think the portfolio that was transferred by the former Attorney General exceeded $1 million. And so if those assets were to be divested, any unrealized gains would immediately become taxable because they would become realized gains. And you would subject that particular person to a probably in excess of 25% of their portfolio being spent immediately as taxes, which would have a chilling effect on being involved as a successful person in public office. I think that's one of the reasons that blind trusts were established, so that people could be out there. If you look at the American Banking Bankers Association, in their banking terminology, calls a blind trust a trust set up to prevent the owner from having detailed knowledge of the assets in the trust.
Yes, and that's Senator Seekins, for explanation, the reason for this is if you have a large amounts of assets and you put them into a trust, you're going to know what's in that trust.
You're going to know initially what's in
You're going to know what's initially in the trust. And then there, if there is no requirement for any divestiture in that, you're going to know for a long period of time. And also, you know, the tax consequences that you're talking about would be correct if there was a zero cost basis for those assets. And that's correct. Yeah. And then you would be looking at that because everything would be capital gains.
However, and you know, if you did, I understand that. But they go on to say in the American bankers industry that government officials frequently use blind trust to avoid conflicts of interest between their official duties and personal financial transactions. But I do know that you wouldn't have it that high. I understand that.
Right.
But you, there is a significant tax problem there. Let's use, for an example, our current governor. I'll bet you that he has tax, that he has bank shares that he bought over 20 years ago, probably 25 years ago, that he still owns, and some of those from previous that. If he was said, you can transfer these assets into a blind trust, and but those assets must be divested as soon as you, as they go into the trust, again, you're discouraging successful people from being involved in government, and I'm that's just an opinion, and I just wanted
sure.
to make
and thank you, and I recognize that, and remember the blind trust utilization doesn't have to be with all your assets.
Right.
It only has to be of those assets that you think that you are going to have an activity which is going to be in ethical conflict of your actions as an executive. And so we are not talking about saying, oh, everyone has to divest of all their assets and put them in a blind trust. This is a mechanism that would be voluntarily used by a person who thought that they were going to have an ethical conflict with certain stocks or certain assets that they own. And as long as they put that into some place that they would remain fairly confident would remain in that trust until some future time, whatever actions they would take would have effect on their assets. And so that's what this is here for. Well, and the, you know, the committee is welcome to discuss it. And that's what we have. Representative Greenberg, then Representative Rampers.
I am very concerned about what the senator has said. That will have a real chilling effect on a number of people going in, people who are good, honest people. And I think, if I may dialogue with the senator for a minute.
Representative Greenberg.
What you're talking about are lines 9 and 10 of the amendment.
Yes.
If those were to be deleted, that would satisfy that concern.
Well, you may want to look at one other thing again, and I believe I understand the chair's intent, who is the drafter of the amendment, if I understand.
That's correct.
Then you might, the reference to 3950.040 should be directly referenced to the section of the Ethics Act rather than to the provision that allows a public official to transfer those acts in for many different reasons. 3950.040 has to do with public official financial disclosures and how they can, going into office, the governor may choose to put all of his portfolio into a blind trust.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, that would this amendment would require him all of those assets to be divested. I would eliminate that, but I also would change the reference on line 8 to that section of the Executive Ethics Act.
Mr. Senator, I think that that's the only statute I'm aware that defines a blind trust. I've given that out. I hope you have a copy of it, too.
Yes, and I think probably do that by saying as defined in.
Oh, as defined in. I see. Oh, okay. Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grimberg.
I'm going to offer the thing I've done before. Could we label that Amendment Number 1 to Amendment Number 1? Because I'm going to offer a couple
right.
Okay. Then I'm going to offer a second amendment to Amendment Number 1, and that is on line 8, change the word under to as defined in. For the reasons stated.
Okay, and I'll object for discussion. So we're changing blind trust as defined in, so that's the, and as a provision of this chapter, meaning 3952, therefore...
I'll get to that in a minute. I'm not sure what we mean as, and a provision of this chapter.
That's what it was meant to mean, but...
I'm sorry?
So, okay, so you're just changing the word under to as defined in at this point.
And if I could, Representative Gruenberg...
I see your point. I see your point. That's not quite grammatical as if we say as defined in 3950.040 and a provision of this chapter. We'd have to say or under this chapter or something like that.
You may want to change the citation for the section on line 7 as well.
No, don't go there. Mr. Chair, I think that I want to just, let's do this in baby steps.
Okay,
so my first offer is to change under to as defined in.
Okay, are there objections to that change? Seeing none, that'll be amendment number 2.
Then I'm going to...
And that will be on page 1, line 8 of the amendment number 1. Changing the word under to as defined in.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
The phrase on line 8, quote, and a provision of this chapter is very vague. I do not understand what the drafter meant by that.
You know drafters. it was Representative Gruenberg, I just respond that this provision was to apply to a blind trust utilized in this ethics in this section of the Ethics Act.
Well, then why don't we say, and this is going to be conceptual, I think I see what you're meaning. Instead of say, and a provision of, you might want to say, for the purposes of this chapter.
Can I explain that? Yeah. I think I see that, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Senator
King. The drafter inserted this section of that he has here into the public official financial disclosure section of the statutes. Rather than...
No, he didn't.
Well, it's 3952.415 blind trust. Okay.
The 3950 is the financial disclosure.
Right, that's great.
This is
okay,
the...
I got it. You're right. So, and so... Okay. I think that reads correctly. I'm sorry. I got my own self confused. I think it reads correctly, and it basically refers to the Executive Ethics Act.
And that's the purpose of this, so we'll put that in, and we're going to make this a conceptual amendment again,
so
it goes back for drafting.
So we'll say, and a provision of, say, for the purposes of this chapter.
That would be fine.
Okay, so my amendment number 3 is to delete the phrase, and a provision, and to, for those three words, say, for the purposes. And that's conceptual. That's number 3.
And is there objection? I won't object to that. So, yes.
Was amendment 2 to amendment 1 adopted?
Yes,
was
amendment.
There was no objection.
There was no objection. Amendment 2 was adopted. Sorry, I didn't restate that. So we have amendment number 3, changing and a provision to. For the purposes of this chapter, still on line 8 of Amendment 1. Is there any objection to that? See no objection. We have that. Well, let's see. Representative Ramirez?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I feel especially blessed this morning because I'm not burdened by a law degree. So I'm able to approach SB 186 as a layperson, and I like it. And I like it for two reasons. The first is that it protects the public and allows them a methodology for approaching ethics issues in an appropriate and responsible fashion. But the second reason that I like Senate Bill 186 is it helps us attract the best people into the executive branch of government. And we need better people running our government. And I don't think that this amendment, with all due respect, Mr. Chairman, helps attract the best people. So I am delighted with Representative Gruenberg's amendments to the amendment, but I don't like this amendment, and I intend to vote against it.
And that'll be fine. Representative Gruenberg, did you have an additional amendment?
Yes. Hopefully this may go some towards assisting with your feelings, Representative Ramos. I am persuaded by the tax implications of this. This would have terrific adverse tax consequences for somebody entering the executive branch. And it's because of the language in subsection 1 on lines 9 and 10. And my thought was just to move to delete them. And I would be prepared to offer that amendment, but I'd like to hear from the sponsor of the main amendment, the chair of this committee, whether there would be a way potentially of solving that problem other than that, because I don't see, and I'm not interested in weakening the Ethics Act at all, but I just think that would have terrific adverse consequences and deter a lot of people from going in. And I think on a policy basis, and I'd be willing to take any heat that comes from offering the amendment to the amendment, I think it's really serious.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, just a minute. I'll answer the question. The purpose of the amendment is more adequately found in the next part that we go to, and that is where it says on the lines of the bill, or the public officer does not have management control over the financial interest. And in that section, that means the public officer knows exactly what's in it. I mean, many of us have managed accounts, and we get a quarterly report or a monthly report. We know exactly what's in there. We may not have management control whether we're buying and selling things out of that portfolio, but we know what's in it. And so how do we escape? We are putting into this part of the bill saying you do not have an ethical conflict if you don't have the management control. Even if you know you have it there, it's a real problem. I mean, because it does rise to an ethical concern. Buying and selling the assets is not what creates the ethical conflict. The ethical conflict comes from if you have an asset which you can make more valuable by your actions, that is what causes the ethical conflict. So the next amendment would be to take out that management control section and leave it as a blind trust. However, to my understanding, for this ethical violation, there would only be things put in there which you voluntarily wanted to put in and to escape a ethical problem. And as long as you know you put them in and they're not being sold, there's a potential they could be sold. But if you put a significant portfolio in there with significant $100,000 holdings in a single stock, and you anticipate it's still there, then that would remain. So that's the purpose for this specific definition of a blind trust for this specific provision in the ethics bill. And that's what it's there for. And it's here for committee discussion. And so let's go on. Representative Lynn, and then Gardner. Representative Lynn.
I'd like to know the sponsor of this bill thinks of amendment number one as it's currently amended. The whole subject of this amendment number one as currently amended, do you feel this is necessary? You think it's good, bad, or should we amend it further to make it better? Where are you on this Amendment 1 as currently amended?
And just for clarification for the recorder, right now we're having discussion basically on Amendment Number 1, not on Amendment Number 3 to Amendment Number 1.
Right.
So we don't have that amendment before us now. Was Amendment Number 3 offered?
And adopted.
Yeah.
And it was number 3 was adopted, yes. Without.
So there's no pending amendment to the amendment?
No, there isn't. So we're back to discussion.
That's why I'd like to know what the sponsors general feeling is on the total amendment number one as currently amended. Do you like the concept or don't like the concept?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lynn, I would say the blind trust is something that I would like to see left in our ethics laws, because it does provide a purpose or a way that someone who is a successful individual who's had to disclose what was in that portfolio already, to place it then in outside of their management control. I'm speaking to this amendment, but also partly to the other one that the chairman was just talking about that you're going to be looking at. I think the reason that we put in there, or other, what was it, management control, or Representative Seaton, was simply because I think we were trying to not preclude other mechanisms that duplicated the same thing with a blind trust, but that they shouldn't be able to, they should have that confidentiality. So I wouldn't have any objection to that other language being stricken. I think it was just a matter of trying to draft it. But I think if there's anything in there that says you have to divest of that asset, and I wasn't sure to follow the amendment at this point, and take those tax ramifications now, I think it has a chilling effect. That's just my opinion. And the chairman and I have already discussed that prior to coming here today, so he knew what I...
And that would be line 9.
Yes, if that was still there, then I think you're losing the opportunity to draw people into government at the end of their careers, where they're looking for some place where they no longer can gain, but they can contribute, mm-hmm. from being able to do that without harming the financial security of their family. And so that's my concern.
And Representative Gardner.
Thank you. To me, it seems that the chilling effect would be not on someone's ability to be in office, but on their ability to make public decisions, which they have reason to believe would benefit them. And outside of management control, as a blind trust is, does not mean has no personal interest or stake in the outcome. And that's where we need to find a solution. If I have valuable assets and I don't want to pay the taxes on them, and I put them in a blind trust, I know they're in the blind trust, I have every reason to expect they're still going to be there after I finish my public service. I have an interest and a stake in the outcome of decisions I make. And I think that if we want to serve the public good, we need to remove that possibility. We can serve, and we can not deal with issues that directly affect our own assets, whether they're in a blind trust or not.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could,
Senator Seacon.
I think what you end up with then is you end up with a universe of potential selectees for high position in the administration of people who have never been successful in their own life and career in terms of investing in their portfolio. And I think by doing that, you severely limit the talent pool that could be otherwise available for you. But again, I will point out, these are assets when they're put in the blind trust that have already been publicly disclosed according to our public disclosure laws.
Now, Senator Seacon, would you explain that? Because my understanding from your conversation before, this covers 15,000 employees in the executive branch, not just the commissioners and the governor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have corrected me again, and my thought patterns were rising to those people where the greatest conflict does exist in terms of stock portfolio, and that is the commissioners, the top elected officials. And you're right. The average state employee probably does not have a significant stock portfolio, but many of them have stock portfolios. They have 401ks. They have other things that go along with that are also that also could be affected. And so my mind keeps going to those people that I'm trying to attract to the cabinet.
and again, we're talking about not the fact that you have stock portfolio or that you have assets, but only if you are in a situation where the executive branch action that you are going to take is going to significantly impact the value of that asset, and it rises above the value of $10,000.
Yes, and that can happen in some cases, that 1% or 10,000 comes in there. But it is not normal in the 401k that you're going to get there, but you could. It could happen. And some people have pretty significant 401k programs.
Sure. And again, it's not just the 401k and the value. It's that you have to be taking an action which is influencing that investment. So,
and that's true, and there's an old saying that I've – it's kind of a it's a wee bit of a pun, but there's an old saying in the private industry: no conflict, no interest. And those people who generally have the biggest conflict have the biggest interest and are generally the best expert you want to advise you.
Let's see, Representative Grunberg, or Representative Gardner, and then Grunberg. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Under current ethics law, there's no requirement or provision for blind trust that's being introduced in this bill. Are we aware of these 15,000 employees we have and other potential employees? Are we aware of anybody who hasn't come into the government to date because of the lack of a blind trust provision in our ethics law?
Mr. Chairman, no, because we do have a blind trust law that's there where they can put that in just to avoid any conflict of interest. We do have that in available to someone, but I have not polled members of those who have not come into public service to find out if that's the reason why they didn't. I didn't.
Yes, Representative Grunberg?
I would think that there are a number of very successful classified employees who potentially might use this. And I'm going to give you an example. Somebody's a land officer, and they have a parcel of land that is in a subdivision, and they're selling off or giving off other parcels. And their parcel might very well be affected by what the land disposal is. And so, I mean, this affects a lot of people, and I'm sure a lot of them buy Fords from you. You know, so you know firsthand that these people are very substantial members of the community. I am going to offer an amendment here that deletes lines 9 and 10 and conform the rest so you wouldn't have a 2. Actually, it's to delete subsection paren 1, close paren, starting on line 9 and continuing on to line 11, through the little paren 2, close paren. So the thing would just start an asset originally transferred.
Okay, Representative Grunberg, I think that what we...
That's conceptual?
Well, I don't think that there's anything left in the amendment. So I think that if we do that, I think we should just vote down the amendment, because they would still be held in a blind trust. The blind trust just wouldn't be quite as blind. So... you know, if that's your intent, there...
No, it's not. I think this is a good amendment, aside from that one issue.
Well, the only issue that this amendment deals with, Representative Grunberg, is whether a blind trust will be blind for the ethics bill, or whether it will be, you put your assets in and you retain knowledge of, you could retain knowledge of this. So, I mean, if we take out the divestiture and the those other portions are still there, because you're talking about the second section is
and it continues to be held. And it also specifically says you can do a blind trust, and it from the amendment number one to amendment number one, it tightens up the definition of blind trust for the purposes of the Ethics Act. It says that they can't be disclosed, and not just to the trustor, but to anybody associated with the trustor.
Okay.
I hope you don't withdraw the amendment.
So your amendment was offered to delete line 9 and 10. Are there any objections?
Yes.
Objection? You wish to speak to the objection?
I think we've discussed it.
Okay. Representative Gatto.
Yeah, thanks. This is to the sponsor. Let's just hypothetically say you live in Juneau in your own home, and you're a successful businessman, you own a $600,000 home, which in this vicinity is not that unusual. Would you have to put that in a blind trust if indeed before your committee was coming legislation that it indicated we might have to move the capital? And therefore you would say, gosh, what will happen to the value of my home? Would that have to be in a blind trust then?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, I do not believe so, because I don't believe that's an investment asset, but that's, you might look at your home as an investment, but it's where you live, and I think it's exempt from the provision. But if you have a piece of property, that could be an investment.
Okay, same situation, sure.
You want to have that dialogue?
Yeah, I would just like to go ahead and talk about this amendment. I think it doesn't quite cover enough of deleting. I think it, if we're going to delete that, we probably ought to delete lines 11 through 16 as well, because they deal with an asset that's transferred into the trust, would continue to be there until you're notified that it's no longer there. Well, that's, again, the blind trust is then telling you know what's in your blind trust until you're notified that it's no longer there. So it's exactly the opposite if we take out line 9 and 10 of where we were trying to go with the amendment. So I would like the amendment to include, I'd like you to withdraw and offer the amendment lines 9 through 16.
May we dialogue on that for a moment?
Representative Groomer.
Let's say I own 100 stocks in International Widget, 100 shares, goes into the blind trust. At some point, I cease to know what's there. I mean, I may have a good idea that International's still in there. But at some point, the broker sells it. And then they notify either me or they notify the personnel board. Then they notify me that they and my supervisor that the International is now gone. I don't know when International is sold until after that event occurs.
Well, and Representative Groom, the point is if you had 10 assets that you put in there, and you have to be told when those assets are sold. With 6 of them are sold, you know that you still have the other 4 assets. So yeah. The blind trust is obviously, there's not even any question. It's anything that had a value of over $10,000 is going to be known to be still in that trust until you're notified that it's gone. So it totally defeats the idea of the blind trust.
Now if we do that, then we might as well the purpose it sounds like amendment number 4 to amendment number 1 guts amendment number 1. I'm going to withdraw amendment number 4 because I don't see anything left if we do what you're suggesting. I mean, you know, it's just meaningless. So I am not going to, under those circumstances, offer amendment number 4 to amendment number 1.
Is there any more discussion on amendment number 1?
The amendment to delete lines 9 and 10, in other words.
That's correct. Because it would make the whole thing meaningless, because the sponsor then would want to delete lines 11 to 16, and there's nothing left.
Is there any other discussion on amendment number 1? Seeing no discussion on amendment number 1, Madam Secretary, would you call the roll? This is on amendment number 1 as amended. We had 3 wording changes on line. We had 2 wording changes on line 8.
Representative Ramirez.
No.
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
No.
Representative Gatto.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Lynn.
No.
Chair Seaton.
Yes.
3 yay, 4 nay.
Okay.
Okay, amendment number four fails to carry. Oh, number, amendment number one.
Screw me there.
And I would now like you to switch one page here and go to conceptual amendment, the second page, where it says page 3, line 30.
Where are you?
It's the second page of your amendment package. And the reason I'm doing that, and that will be amendment number two, conceptual amendment number two, is because that failed to include the next part of page 1. Page 3, line 30, you'll see is the same word, or other investment where the employee does not have management control over the financial interest. That's the same language as on page 1 following blind trust, and that just got left out of there. So if, I'd offer amendment number 2 and offer an amendment to number 2 to also delete page 1, line 12, after trust. Through line 13, ending in interest. That'd be just before or. So it would delete, or the public officer does not have the management control over the financial interest, which is essentially the same language as we have on those other two citations. But since we're trying to go through the bill in order here. And just to explain this, we talked just a minute ago with the senator about this as well, and the idea is that if you have a management portfolio or a managed account, you know what's in that managed account. You're getting quarterly reports, and so it's not the same as a blind trust. Is there any objection to the amendment number, conceptual amendment number two?
No, this is amendment number one. Did we adopt your amendment number one to amendment number two yet? I didn't think we did that yet.
Oh, maybe we did. This is amendment number one to amendment number two. Is there any objection to that? It's just adding the same. It's a similar language on page one that occurs in those other two citations. It was just missed. Seeing no objection, then amendment number one to amendment number two is adopted. And now we're on to amendment number two, which I was just discussing. And is there any objection to amendment number two?
Take a read here. Okay.
And I believe, Senator Seekins, just for clarity, you didn't have an objection to...
I have no objection to that amendment, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection from the committee? Seeing none, amendment number two is adopted. Okay, now let's go back to the next page, and the previous page of that amendment package, and we'll do that as conceptual amendment number three. It's page 2, line 6, insert a new D and renumber accordingly.
Mr.
Representative Groomer.
I would like to offer a substitute for that. I basically had this drafted by legal, and this is the only amendment with my name on it. It's the X.6 Chenoweth, and could we call that amendment number one? Well, Mr. Chair, maybe it'd be easier. May I ask?
Yes.
Would you be willing to withdraw your amendment? I'll just offer.
Representative Groomberg, I'll withdraw my amendment. But I don't have a copy of yours.
You don't have a copy of mine.
Oh, me. Okay, and so you're offering amendment X.6.
Do you want to do that now or take yours first and come back to this?
It's the same thing, it's just more detailed.
Since this one.
We talked about this last time.
Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to this amendment. I think it it brings into something that I didn't think about, because normally stock options are granted to someone in a high executive position in a company, mm-hmm. and I didn't anticipate that.
But they can be quite valuable.
They can be.
Did you offer this yet?
I'm delighted to do it. Do you want me to do it now?
No.
We'll go through your packet.
Okay, we'll go through mine. Sorry for the confusion, folks. Let's go back to that first page one, and it's conceptual amendment number 3. I'm still going to offer it.
You're going to offer it?
I'm going to offer it, yeah.
Oh.
And because it deals with more than the stock.
Stocks? Because of the use of the word purchase.
Right, and or other option. Okay, so I'm offering conceptual amendment number 3, which is on page 2, line 6, insert a new D. Does everybody have that amendment? And what that does, I'll offer that amendment. Is there an objection to the amendment?
Just for the purpose of discussion.
Thank you. For the purpose of discussion, what this does is says that if you have a stock option or a purchase option for the business or any other option that pertains to the business, that's what it involves. And we've seen several things where it's not just a stock option. You can own 25% of the business. It may not be a business. It may be an LLC. It may be a partnership. It may be that you're granted 50% ownership in something. So to cover all those bases, whether it's a stock option, any other kind of option, to purchase into the business is probably more significant than a dollar amount, because there is a there was a prospective arrangement of obtaining the business. And so if that's there, I think that we have a problem, and we should not exempt that in at all. And so anyway, I'm offering amendment number 3. Representative Lynn, did you want to speak to your objection?
No, I didn't. Okay. For discussion.
Representative Groomer.
I think that hopefully we could combine these into a single amendment. Let me make you a suggestion, Mr. Chair. That rather than starting with yours, let's start with mine and put yours as a number 3 on here. So it would just be conceptually as a little I. I mean, you know, but we'll have to schmooze the language. I'm going to suggest some language on that. And what the language would basically be, conceptually, I would say, does not have any other have any purchase option or any other option that pertains to the business, something like that. I'm not sure exactly what, but you know, basically put.
Rip them go.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It was a very confusing sentence when I read it, because D says does not have any stock, comma. And then purchase or other options, and I guess purchase options or other options, did it mean does not have any stock options?
Yes.
With putting the comma there, I think kind of distorts the statement, because it clearly sets off by itself, does not have any stock. And then the next segment refers to options. So I would want to add the word stock options, purchase options, or other options, or else ask the drafter to be sure that it includes stock options and not stock.
That's correct, and that's the intent. And I would take that as a friendly amendment. I think we're going to get too confused, Representative Grunberg, if we go because yours has is in conflict, as you're talking about certain levels of stock options.
Well, this is in the bill. This is in the bill now. I mean, it's in the law now.
Right.
I'm sorry, you know, I'm sorry, it's in the bill now.
Right.
So I'm taking, and I think this is somewhat similar to the GARA bill that we passed out of here recently, and it's in accord with the recommendations that were made during the Rankus affair. I just tried to put the concept of stock options in here.
Right, and I think I'm going to maintain my amendment here because this amendment deals with stock, with options, and I accepted yours as a friendly amendment to put stock option, purchase option, or other options. So it's very clear that we're talking about any kind of an option for ownership of the business, and it's not limited to a 1% or there. If you have a option to get an interest in that business, it's there is an inherent conflict with what you're going to be dealing with. And so that's my so I'm going to maintain this amendment. Representative Groomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Suppose that you acquire an option for one share in a business. Are you prohibiting that? It's something that's stat de minimis?
The purpose of having under this section, it is a personal financial interest, is this is under the definition, and if you're acquiring an option in the business, it is going to be difficult to ascertain the percentage or the amount. Having an option for acquisition of a business or a partnership is going to be very difficult to tie to an exact dollar amount or percentage. So, yeah, I'm going to maintain this. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. With regard to Representative on your left statement, suppose you only have one share. Well, if I have a company that has five shares, me, my wife, and my three children, a single share is worth 20% of the company.
Mr. Chair. You're right. Technically, I didn't define. Suppose you only have one share in a big company. I mean, you know, there's far less than 10% or 1%. The thing that I'm trying to get at is that the reason that there is in the legislation the 1% or $10,000 de minimis exception is because otherwise you couldn't have even a small, tiny interest in the business, and I don't think that there is any evidence that we have that that creates that substantial a conflict. There are a couple of different issues here.
Sure.
When you're talking about acquiring a business, that's a lot more by definition than 10%. So it's illegal under this. But I thought what you were talking about, well, and other options that pertain to the business, you could have an option to supply things to the business, or an option, like in your fish business, to purchase fish from the business. That would be an option that pertains to the business.
That's correct.
Are you going to prohibit that too?
Prohibit an option?
Yeah, that's what you're doing.
Right.
You're saying you can't. It's a conflict of interest if you have an option. So I'm an executive branch employee, and I want an option to buy fish from the Seton Fish Processing Company. That would be unethical here. And that's just a business deal. You're either a supplier or a purchaser. Are you planning to, prohibit that? I thought we're talking about ownership interests here. So I'm going to, with due respect.
Sure. That's what this discussion is about.
I'm going to ask that my amendment be considered an amendment in substitute to conceptual amendment number 3, because, and I'm happy to add something to it to do what you're suggesting.
So we have a motion to substitute, or Representative Gardner.
I have a comment.
Yes.
I think we're looking at it out of context, because what the bill says is unethical conduct is prohibited, but there's no impropriety if the public officer's personal or financial interest in the matter is insignificant, or the public officer doesn't have any stock option, purchase option, or whatever. So in the context, it makes sense. It's saying the matter is insignificant. That's the first criterion, or the second one. And if your example fits in the first one, then the second one's not.
May I respond? The word insignificant is on line 7 and 8. Mm-hmm. And under the bill, that's deleted. And these are made much more certain, they're defined, so you don't get into a legal hassle on whether something's insignificant. This is the definition uh-huh. that we're dealing with of what's insignificant.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for allowing me to be here. I've got to go hear Representative Lynn's bill in my Senate Judiciary Committee. So don't want to hold his bill up. I do thank you, gentlemen and lady, for the opportunity to be with you this morning.
We'll talk with you later. Thank you for coming. So we have a motion to substitute Representative Gruenberg, motion X6 for conceptual number 3.
May I
inquire? Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Is it the chair's intention to pass this bill out today? Because if not, maybe we should work and see if we can come to some kind of a
accommodation. Sure, we can do that. We can put that on hold and work on that for better language.
Yeah, you're not.
Yes, Representative Gatto.
Yeah, thanks again. We did take pains to remove the word insignificant on line 7.
Yeah, right.
But it appears again on line 10, and I'm just curious to know if that was an oversight. Are we trying to avoid the use of the word insignificant?
Which page are you on?
On the first page.
May I respond to that?
Yes.
They're used in two different senses. One defines the quantity of an interest in the business. The other defines the type of action that is taken vis-a-vis the business. So I think that keeping it on line 10 is appropriate because it's used in a different sense.
If I can respond, I have no way to quantify the word insignificant because it varies from person to person. So just for the sake of keeping the integrity of the bill in order, maybe we just don't want to use that term and we need to substitute a term that is more significant.
Shall we put that aside for our next round here as well?
Can I briefly respond on that?
Briefly, and then we'll. Okay. Yeah, Representative Gatto will work on his language.
That is something, speaking, because I, as you know, I sit on the Legislative Ethics Committee, and these are the kinds of things that, in a quasi judicial capacity, the committee has to exercise some discretion. So I would hope that we don't touch that language on line 10, because that's got to be up to the triers.
Okay, proceeding on, so we have put aside amendment number 3 as amended that was adopted with putting option after stock and option after purchase for amendment number 3. Put the commas there. So we are now on to number 4, mm-hmm. and that would, it says page 3, line 30, and then says nothing after it. If you'd scratch that out, that's a typo. And so it should read, delete page 8, line 16 through 24, which is section 15. That is the subsection that has the fine and for disclosure.
So you're deleting section 15 of the bill.
Deleting section 15.
And renumber.
And renumbering accordingly. That's a conceptual amendment number 4, and I'll offer that one. Their objection.
I object, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ramos for discussion?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, doesn't that gut the intent of this bill? I've been following this from news accounts mostly, and, you know, criminal penalties and now a $5,000 fine. Doesn't this go right to the heart of the whole ethics bill?
Representative Ramos, this ethics bill, you know, contains a lot more than that. It defines the amounts. It defines that. It defines whether you can have business partners. It brings in business partners as well as members of the family. So it does many more things. So it does delete the portion that says that a member of the public that would a person who discloses information in this confidential would be subject to a fine. Yes, it deletes that section. It leaves it such that in the current version, where we currently have it, if you falsify or file something that you know is not true, you are subject to misdemeanor, I believe it is, penalties.
False swearing
penalties.
It
does not put a separate new section of law for someone who discloses that they're about to or did file a ethics complaint. But it would not relieve one from filing a false ethics complaint and the charges that would arise from that. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 15 addresses penalties to the public who disclose an ethics bill. That's not the heart of our ethics bill. And I think we could have a very strong ethics bill without having penalties for the public.
There are further discussion. Representative Gatto.
Just go back to almost the opening statements that said it is not the individual that makes the complaint so much as the organizations that pick up the complaint, broadcast it, and are protected. And so I believe we're looking at the wrong people when we try to assess a fine against an individual for making a statement, even though the statement may be an exaggeration. And so I support the amendment.
Is there any other discussion on amendment number 4? Representative Ramos, you object to number 4 still?
Yes, sir.
Secretary, would you call a roll on amendment number 4? That deletes page 8, lines 16 through 24.
Mr. Chair.
And renumbers. Yes.
I'm going to stand corrected on something just so the record before we vote on this. If you make a false statement under oath, that's perjury, which is a Class B felony. Unsworn falsification is if you do it with the intent to mislead a public servant in the performance of a duty, you submit a false written or recorded statement. And that's on a thing that's either application for a benefit or on a form bearing a notice that false statement made in it are punishable, and that's Class A misdemeanor. That's not sworn under oath. That's the difference.
Sure. Can you give us the section there?
Yep, sure.
I think that's
it's AS 11.56.200 and .210, but the whole thing is perjury and related offenses, AS 11.56.200 through 240. And I have that here if anybody wants to see it.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Grimberg. Is there any other discussion on amendment number 4? Seeing none, Secretary, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Gatto.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Lynn, not present. Representative Ramris.
No.
Chair Seaton.
Yes.
4 yay, 2 nay.
Amendment number 4 is carried. Next is amendment number 5. You turn the page, it reads a conceptual amendment again, and that is page 8, line 26. Wrongful use of a complaint, and it's changing from shall to may. The board may find there has been wrongful use of the complaint.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
I'm just objecting for the purpose of discussion.
Yeah, and I'm offering the amendment.
This was something that I had mentioned last time, because the board must have the discretion to exercise its full judicial capacity. And we can't direct the board to find a finding of guilt. I mean, there are severe constitutional problems with doing that. So I think we have to say may.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Is there any other discussion? Do you maintain your objection?
No, I withdraw my objection.
Anybody else object to amendment number 5? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number 5 is adopted. To page 8, line 26, changing shall to may. Next would be conceptual amendment number 6. And that is on page 9, lines 3 and 4, delete all material. And that's being deleted because the reference is to 52.340 and we eliminated 340.
And that's the same with 16 and 17.
And on 16 and 17, yes, we're deleting that because we have deleted the fine. Up to $5,000 fine.
I'll object.
Objection, Representative Ramirez. And
this is almost just a conforming amendment.
That's correct. It is. It conforms to what we've done before. Representative Ramirez,
yes, sir.
To your objection.
I just think we shouldn't have amended Section 15 out of the bill, so I object to this amendment for the same reason.
Oh, okay. Any other questions? Secretary, would you please call the roll? And that is on conceptual amendment number 6, page 9, deleting line 3 and 4, and page 9, line 16 and 17, deleting.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes, on amendment 6.
Representative Gatto.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Lynn, not present. Representative Ramirez.
No.
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Chair Seaton.
Yes.
4 yay, 2 nay.
Amendment number 6 is adopted. And that is that packet of amendments. Are there other amendments to be offered to this bill at this time? We will hold while we work on amendment number 3 and language from Representative Gatto. Yes, Representative Grunberg.
I probably should have suggested this as another conforming amendment to the last amendment, but if members would look on page 9, lines 18 to 19, that references subsection C3, which we've just deleted. The AG may enforce C3. So okay. I'm going to make that amendment number 7 to delete subsection D on lines 18 to 19 of page 9.
Okay, so we have amendment number D, or number 7, deleting page 9, lines 18 through 19, subsection D, which referred to a section that we have just deleted. Are there any objections? Yes, Representative.
Just a question. Since the previous amendments were conceptual, would the drafter automatically refer to that, or is that necessary for us to address?
Never assume they'll do anything. I would hope they would.
Yes.
But who knows?
All right.
And that's why they were conceptual, is to let them do it. But
I'll
when we pick them up
objection.
A bit. Okay, thank you. Is there any objection to that conforming amendment? Seeing amendment 7 adopted.
Now, I have one other, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Grimmer.
And this, I'm not sure what the sponsor's feeling would be, so I'm sort of raising it now just to talk about it. On line, page 8, line 28, if they find that there's been wrongful use of an executive ethics complaint, they have to have due process requirements, including a hearing, but it doesn't specifically say that the hearing must be public. And I think it should be a public hearing. And I don't know if legally the term hearing implies that it be public. I don't think it does. So I'm going to offer amendment number 8 to page 8, line 28. Before the word hearing, insert the word public. That's a due process requirement. You have a right to a public hearing in most circumstances.
And I'll object for discussion here. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Would it say if requested, including a public hearing if requested? I mean, we're talking about.
Sure, I would accept that as a friendly amendment. Sure. Public hearing, comma, if requested.
Okay. Is there any other discussion on amendment number 8? Or, first of all, that was adopted as a friendly amendment. There wasn't an objection. Mm-hmm. Is there any objection to amendment number 8, which on page 8, line 28, inserts public before hearing and comma, if requested, after the word hearing?
I guess.
Yes, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, again. In reading the entire sentence, the board may find that there has been wrongful use of executive branch complaint if it determines after compliance with due process requirements, including a public hearing if requested in a majority vote, that the complainant, and I would ask, I want to be absolutely sure who is the person that is entitled to request the public hearing. Is it the complainant or the board?
The complainant presumably would be the defendant in an action to determine whether the complaint was filed in a wrongful manner. So they could make the request, so could the board.
Okay, so this either allows could. Either.
Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. So we are on amendment number 8. Are there any... I'll remove my objection. Are there any other objections to amendment number 8, putting public in front of hearing and if requested after? Seeing no objection, number 8 is adopted. Are there any other objections or any other amendments? Representative Gardner.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. Are we going to try to pass this out today or hold
it? No, we've got an amendment to work on, and there's some language by Representative Gatto. But if you do have an amendment, it would be good if we could at least...
I've passed it out, but I'm not prepared to offer it today.
Okay, but you did pass it out.
Yes.
So everybody will take a look at that between now and the next hearing. And at that, we will put aside this bill.
Mr. Chair, where does this bill go after State Affairs?
State Affairs.
I believe it goes to finance.
Finance.
It doesn't have a judiciary referral.
Do I have a fiscal note?
No.
Zero, I think.
In fact, I think it does have a judiciary referral.
Oh, does it?
Yes. I think it
does. I didn't think it did.
Louis, does this have a judiciary referral? I thought it did.
I was surprised. I could be wrong.
It does have fiscal notes. There's zero. State Affairs and Judiciary.
Yeah. So we'll go to Judiciary.
Well, that's fine. You didn't have a bite at this apple, Representative Kernberg.
Okay, now we are on to House Bill 347, Motor Vehicle Insurance and Notice. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. After the last meeting, there were a series of technical wording changes that the committee and Mr. Bannock had proposed, so we've written those up with Representative Gardner's office, and I believe you may have those in front of you. I think they're all pretty technical in nature.
Yeah. And we do have those. There was a cover sheet, which was a...
We had some other stuff. I've got this, Louis.
Louis Flora at the top of it. It's an email from Dwayne Bannock, who submitted Representative Garrett, did you submit this package of amendments, or are those submitted by...
He offered them to me. I'm submitting them to the committee.
There's something from Dwayne Bennett.
So we have a package of amendments here that are based on the email that we have here that Dwayne Bennett, DMV, suggested some changes to the bill. Representative Gardner, did you want to...
Yes. I'll offer individually, I guess, amendment number one, which is page 2, line 2, following department, insert notwithstanding AS 28.05.121. And this one, is Dwayne Bennett online?
Yeah. Are you...
Just a minute. Are we on G2? No, that's amendment. Sorry.
G. Just version G?
Page 2, line 2. Oh.
I think it's version G.
Oh, I think the...
Yeah, version G. Okay. Line 2, following department, notwithstanding citation.
Had we adopted your amendment already?
I don't believe so. So, is there any objection to amendment number one? Seeing no objection, amendment number one is adopted. Representative Gardner, would you like to offer
amendment number two? And again, I think this was Mr. Bannock's suggestion. Page 2, lines 3 and 4, delete most current and insert most recently recorded.
Can I object?
We have an objection.
And I know certainly Mr. Bannock probably understands this more clearly, but what if we know of a more current address which has not been recorded? This prevents us from using an address except one that's been recorded, even though the recorded address may not be able to receive the information. So I'm trying to see the advantage of using the most recorded rather than and deleting a known address. And maybe there's some other language in here. But sometimes you can give information to a police officer that says, oh, no, I have a new address. I moved there just a week ago, and this is where I get my mail.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. What if we use the word most recently provided? Whether it's provided to the police, by the police, to the division, to whomever.
Most recently obtained?
Provided.
May I inquire?
Representative Elkins?
Mr. Chairman, why don't we just leave it at most current? I mean, you know, I think we're...
Well, and if I can answer that.
Representative Gatto.
The most current might be a dead end. And a person could simply say, you know, that's my most current address, but I'm leaving there in a day. Why don't you just send it to my mom, my brother, my anyone? And therefore, you've provided a safe address that you can go to, even though it's not your current address. Thank you. Mr. Bannock online?
Mr. Chair?
Kevin Birchfield from the Division of Motor Vehicles is online.
Okay, good. Kevin, would you have a comment on this, and would you ask why most current was asked to be changed to most recently recorded? And I would direct the committee's attention to we are only dealing with three items. We're not dealing with someone's private knowledge because we are dealing with these following sources are all that's indicated is what you're going to use the most current or the most recently recorded from only those three sources.
Most recently recorded, I believe, is preferred so that we can use the one from the accident report that is provided. That is the that is the person that was in the most recent contact with the individual.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gruber.
The use of the word recorded, it doesn't say recorded where or by whom. What do you mean by recorded? Usually, technically, in the law, when you talk about something being recorded, it's a deed that is recorded in the registrar of deeds. What did the term recorded supposed to mean here?
Representative McGuire, do you have a position on this where you'd like recorded or provided or obtained?
Well, could we get an answer from him?
I'm asking Representative McGuire first. Representative McGuire?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I recall, it was the committee that had a problem with the term most current, and so I think this is the language that we ran by Dwayne Bannock, but I think you could use most recently provided. I think you could use most current because, as the chair says, it's of the listed addresses. And so I don't think that and to Representative Gatto, the most current address, if you tell a police officer this is my address now but this is what it's going to be a week from now, when DMV mails out the notice, they're going to know of those which the most current is.
Okay, let me check with the DMV. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name. Would you go ahead and respond?
My name is Kevin Birchfield, and most recently provided is acceptable.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Does anybody have an objection to most recently provided?
Yeah, I have a question.
Representative Gatto.
Yeah, personally, I like the term including but not limited to, which, you know, gives a wide latitude. And certainly lists the three that are on the page, but gives the individual an ability to seek out any other one.
Well, I just want to draw us back into where we're talking about. We're talking about the DMV sending out a notice, and currently they have to send it to the one that they have on file, even if a police report has a more current one. Or the PFD. So, you know, I mean, if we're wanting to go out and say DMV is supposed to go out on an internet search for somebody's address, that's we're stepping far beyond where we are in this bill currently. Representative Gardner.
In response to Representative Gatto's suggestion, if we had language that said most current but not limited to, the person might turn around and say, but you could have sent it to all of them, and you didn't, and therefore you didn't make efforts to reach me. And it opens up, I think, unnecessary problems. I like most recently provided. And the DMV can look at it and say, well, gee, what are the dates on this? Okay, let's use this one.
So, Representative Gatto, you still maintain your objection to changing from most recently recorded to most recently provided?
And if I can comment, most recently provided could be a couple of years old.
Well, the guy just got a ticket, and that's the only reason this is they've got somebody driving without, was engaged in an accident, and provided an address at the accident. So if they provided a year an address that is several years old, they're not wanting to get their notice.
Anyway.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Groomberg.
Kevin, your last name again?
Birchfield.
Okay, Mr. Birchfield. What did you mean by the word recorded?
The reference is to how it appears on the accident report that we receive. It's recorded on the report. It's probably a poor choice of words.
Oh, I see. Okay. So we're going to get away from that for sure.
Yeah.
The most recently, when we're talking about provided, you're talking about provided to whom? Provided to the department or the police or some third party, or who do we mean?
It would be all of the above, actually.
Yeah, and Representative Gruenberg, it's provided among the following, and one is the department.
Right. I see.
Or
okay.
One is the citation or what is it?
So do we have a motion to change the word recorded on line 3 to provided?
I'm waiting for one.
I move.
Good. We have a motion to change the word to insert most recently provided. Is there any objection? Seeing none, we've changed the That's amendment number one to amendment number two.
Yeah.
Seeing no objection, so passed. Now we're back to amendment number two, which is change most current to most recently provided. Is there any objection? Seeing none, amendment two is adopted.
Okay, and then we have another amendment to be I guess amendment number three, page two, line six, delete citation or. Page two, line six.
This is the very bottom one in your packet.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm kind of shuffled them a little.
This is all right.
Inadvertently.
We're in amendment number three.
Yeah, we're in. Which amendment are you offering as number three?
This one.
Was it page two, line six?
Yes. Yeah. Delete citation or.
So the address shown on the police report, because there may not be a citation necessarily, but there's a report.
Okay. That's amendment number three. Are there any amendments to amendment number three?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes, objection.
What is the harm in saying, in leaving in citation? Because there could be a citation. I'm asking Mr. Birchfield, if there happens to be a citation, why couldn't they use that address?
Because the Division of Motor Vehicles does not receive the citations.
I see. Okay.
Great. Thank you for that explanation. I'll remove the explanation. Okay. Is there any objection to amendment number three? Seeing none, amendment number three is adopted. Okay. Representative Gardner.
Amendment number four, page two, lines 7-9. Delete all material and insert accident.
Still finding the. Oh, I see. Okay. So this is number four. Sure. Just
leave the word accident.
Mr. Kevin, what was it, Blatfield?
Birchfield.
Mr. Birchfield, can you tell us what that is about?
Yes. We were wanting it to not state police report, but to state accident report.
Okay, so we took out citation or, so it's now we just the address shown on
the accident report.
The accident report.
Okay, so I think the page numbers on this are incorrect.
And we also didn't want to have the section there about the Department of Revenue application. We didn't want to use the address from that.
Okay, what's happened here is the amendments are kind of mixed up. The one we're addressing is reads page 2, line 7-9, delete all material, insert accident. So basically the address shown
on the accident report.
On the police report of the accident.
Well, this is the amendment that takes out the reference to the permanent fund dividend.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me for interrupting. It's Dwayne Bannock.
Yes.
I'm sorry if I may address that point.
Yeah, you're a little loud there, Dwayne.
Oh, forgive me. Sorry, sir.
Thanks. Go ahead.
We'll move that a little bit. Indeed, this amendment that has been labeled Amendment Number 4 is specific only to the Department of Revenue as it pertains to permanent fund.
Okay.
So philosophically, we have asked that that be removed for some of the same arguments that you've already had earlier, just a few minutes ago, pertaining to things that are outside the field of the Division of Motor Vehicles.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grimberg.
I'd ask Representative Gatto, do you have a problem with the amendment?
That would be Representative Guerra.
Representative Guerra. Well, I'd ask if you have a problem, too, but Representative Guerra, he was the guy I was talking to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunberg, I would leave this up to the discretion of the committee. I think your most accurate address is going to be the one on the citation or the accident report. We thought it would be good to also let you, if there was a more recent PFD application, to let you use that address. Mr. Bannock has a problem with that, and so we really have no position.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. What I see is that in order, it's a problem, is that in order for the DMV to determine whether the PFD address is more current than the accident report, they have to go to the additional step of checking, looking up the PFD application and the date and all of that, and that's not really their bailiwick. I mean, they have an accident report before them, they have an address on the DMV records, and they choose which seems to be the most current and use it. And the idea is to send the information to the person.
Okay. I have a did somebody offer an objection? Okay.
Well,
I'm going to object, and first of all, what I'd like to do is change this so that we're deleting materials on change page 2, lines 7 through 9, to page 2, lines 8 and 9.
That they were eliminating the word and on line 7, too.
Right.
I think this is okay, drafted okay.
It just leaves the word accident in and deletes everything beyond that.
Okay. So I'll remove my objection. Do you, Representative Elkins, do you have an objection to this amendment?
Well, I guess I do sort of, but I just want to relate a story to you why I feel that way.
Sure.
Years ago, I used to buy dividends, government fund dividends. And when they changed the law, I had a lot of money out there that I couldn't get paid for. And I had to take those addresses and find those people and get them to show proof of birth so that they, because the Department of Revenue had determined that if they sold their dividend, they might not be a real person. And I got to tell you, and it was quite a bit of money, and a number of, you know, so obviously quite a few people. Every person that I had to contact, the address was true. And so, you know, I have a little bit of problem taking that out, because people don't fool around. I mean, when they put their permanent fund address down, it's usually bedrock. And that's why, from my experience, anyway, I feel.
And you know, I understand that. I guess my problem is that we are trying to help people that don't have insurance, that fill out a police report or have a recorded address with the department, and if they're filing false addresses, non-current addresses on the police report or the accident report, I hate to put a whole lot of burden on the department to go seek these people who are, if they are putting on non-current or false information on the accident report. So I am, you know, that's why I'm going to support this, because I don't think we need the burden, more burden on the DMV, and but we do want to have the most current address between the police, the accident report, and the and what's on file at DMV. So did you want to object to this, or you were commenting? So is there any objection to this amendment? So without any objection, that will be adopted, and it deletes and on line 7 and all of lines 8 and 9. So Representative Guerra, there was some confusion there. We're still now left with line page 2, line 6 reading, the address shown on the police report of the accident. Is that acceptable language? Or
Mr. Chair, I think DMV's position is it's really called an accident report, not a police report. So they had asked that we change the term police report to accident report.
Is that another amendment? I don't see that we have that.
We're still on amendment number 4.
No, we adopted number 4.
Adopted.
Hang on.
But I do not, I heard that, but I didn't, I don't see that in the amendment package here anywhere. Mr. Bannock, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Would DMV, what is the language we need to have in there to adequately reflect what you're going to get? And of course, you would get that from, oh, do we have enough? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. What I might what I might recommend, I don't believe that amendment number 4 dealt with the issue specifically on line 6. I would recommend that you amend line 6 to delete the word police and replace with the word accident.
Okay, and Mr. Bannock, are you then ending the rest, or is it going to read accident report of the accident?
I guess that's an excellent point. I'm sorry, I should probably say if we simply deleted the word police, then it would read report of the accident. That may be more technically correct.
Okay, fine, thank you.
Thank you for that good call.
Representative Gardner, would you like to offer that amendment? And
I'd be happy to, but Mr. Chair, can I clarify, did amendment number 4 pass?
Yes. I don't recall us taking it.
Oh, I asked and there was no objection.
Okay.
To amendment number 4.
Okay. Amendment number 5 would be to, and it doesn't match your sheet exactly, delete the word police.
Well, this is we have this here.
Except that, as that testified just by Mr. Birchfield.
All right, that's fine.
That would create some.
Okay, and so the amendment is to, on line 6, delete the word police.
And simply read report of the accident.
Okay. Is there any objection to amendment number 5?
Well, the language will be report of the accident.
Yes.
That's correct. The address shown on the report of the accident. See, no objection. Amendment number 5 passes.
Okay.
Representative Gardner, do you have another?
And finally, yes, since I did them out of order, this will be the last one, and it would be number 6.
I don't.
Is that correct? It's in the stapled group, second to the last, page 1, line 6, following infraction, insert.
Okay.
Punishable by a fine not to exceed $300.
Mr. Chair. Could we just
Representative Gruenberg object for discussion?
Could we just have a moment here? There was something that we had. Okay. I'm not going to have an objection, but I thought, and Representative Gary, you correct me if I'm wrong, that when we talked about this before, we were talking about the fact that infraction is not defined in Title 28 anywhere.
Representative Gruenberg, as I recall, we were trying to address your concern about whether or not there was a catch-all fine amount for driving license violations. There is, but it doesn't state an amount. So we wanted the $300 fine to apply to this violation. I think your recommendation was that we come up with a number and apply them to all violations at DMV, and I don't feel comfortable coming up with an amount for the other violations. I don't know what they are or what the fine should be. Right. So we're just saying for this kind of violation, if you don't file the report the police have asked you to file, it's up to a $300 fine. And so I think this is the cleanest way to do it.
Okay. I remove my objection.
Any other objection to amendment number 6? Seeing none, amendment number 6 is adopted. Representative Gardner, did you have any further amendments?
I believe that's it.
Okay. And then if we'd look, we have the amendment that I offered, or that I will offer now, that I mentioned last time.
Number 7?
It's number, yes, this would be number 7, and it's labeled as G2, Lockhart. Objections to amendment number 7. I was waiting.
Sorry, yes, I object.
Representative Gardner.
Well, I applaud the effort to get vehicles off the road when somebody repeatedly drives without a license or without insurance or whatever the issue may be. The problem is if we forfeit the vehicle,
it impacts people disproportionately. Somebody, one person may have a very, very valuable vehicle and somebody else is driving a junker. So the penalty could be very unfair. You know, they lose their car across the board, but it's not impacting people in the same way. So one person who loses his car and it's a junker and his wife needs it to get to work and the family is really struggling not having access to a car is one thing. Somebody else who's very wealthy, the car is impounded and they are forfeited and they just go out and buy another car and their life really isn't impacted in the same way. So when we deal with penalties, they need to be fairly reasonable across the board, and that's my concern about this.
And, you know, of course, the purpose of this and the section is in on page 2 there, where after a motor vehicle maybe that was used in a commission offense can be forfeited. And then this says, and shall order the motor vehicle used in commission of the offense under this section if the person has been has previously been convicted under this section. Mm-hmm. So this is the question of whether we should have driver licenses at all. If we are not going to, if somebody has a suspended or revoked license and are driving once and then are then convicted of driving without a license, and then we find them again on the road driving without a license, obviously the first penalty of saying you're not supposed to drive was not enough, and so on second conviction, this is would be the forfeiture of the vehicle. But it seems to me, if we're not going to say that there is something more than just saying you're not supposed to drive without your license after a second upon second conviction, we're really saying we shouldn't be issuing driver's licenses and we should just let anybody drive. Mm-hmm. Representative Guerra, do you wish to comment on the...
Representative Seaton, members of the committee, certainly adding this this new section, or whether or not to add it, is up to the committee. The only comment I would really have on this one, if you think it's an appropriate penalty, is I mentioned this to the chair, is if the person driving the car without a license is the owner, that seems to be the penalty you're getting at. But what if the car is owned by somebody who didn't know that the person who was driving it had no license? And we had a call like that this summer. A neighbor asked to borrow a car to go to get some groceries, didn't ask whether the adult who they lent the car to had a license. It turned out the adult who they lent it to didn't have a license. And I felt like in that case, the owner of the car received some punishment. I forgot what it was, an impoundment, I think. And I think maybe you should have a defense if the owner of the car didn't knowingly provide it to somebody who didn't have a license, something like that.
Permission of the owner.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruber.
I have problems with the amendment, as I've discussed with the chair. This can be a horribly draconian result for people who are just barely making it, people whom I represent in the poor parts of Anchorage. And people are pulled over for a taillight or something like that, and they find they don't have proof of insurance or something minor like that. And these vehicles are impounded, and the charges accrue at a terrific rate. And the young person, who's often a young person, gets farther and farther behind. I'm definitely not in favor of people driving without insurance or without a license suspended. But the particularly if you have a forfeiture or something like this, that can be way out of proportion to the seriousness of the offense. And so I have difficulty with the amendment.
Sure. And Representative Grunberg, just so everybody's clear, this. First of all, the part about taking somebody's car who didn't know and it wasn't the person that offended, that we can't do that. That's not a forfeiture case, because under the Constitution, you can't take theirs. We've checked with legislative. So if you would even take a vehicle that's has a lien against it, you'd have to pay off the lien. So the forfeiture from someone who is not knowingly involved is not really the case. And this revolves around two things. The first section, all of the first part deals with the forfeiture, and section 6 deals with an impoundment of the vehicle. And we've been having several problems, as you well know. We just had a couple from Anchor Point killed by a person driving without a license again, and just within the last 6 months. And even after that accident, a relative loaned the person, who obviously didn't have a license, loaned him a car, and they were out driving again. And there was no penalty at all for the person that loaned the vehicle. So section 6, if you don't like the forfeiture section, section 6 at least says that the vehicle will be impounded. And so I would hope that we would consider this and split it in two ways, and so that at least we have some consequence for people. At least they have to go down and bail out their car. If they loaned a car to somebody and didn't even bother to find out, or didn't find out if they had a license to drive or not. I mean, at some point in time, if you're loaning what is basically a deadly weapon on our streets to somebody, you ought to be responsible enough to find out whether that person's entitled to drive. And so that's where the section 6 comes in. So they are, you know, I don't want to hold the bill up. There are two different things here. One is the forfeiture sections, and if it turns out that the committee would like to strip that out, I would hope they would consider section 6 of this amendment separately as the impoundment section.
Mr. Chair, to speed this thing along, we can talk about the second part in a minute, but I move that we divide the question, and the portion dealing with section 2, which goes from, and they're going to have to conform the title here. Let's put the title aside, and I would ask that if this amendment in part is adopted, that the title be corrected accordingly. But I would ask that the first portion be from page 1, line 6, through page 3, line 10. And let's call that Part A of Amendment 7, and the other remaining from lines 11 through 21 on page 3, Part B.
And I will accept that as a division of the question.
Then I will move the question on Part A, that we delete, is amendment to delete Part A.
The motion is there an objection? Well, I'll object.
I've said it.
Yeah, is there any other discussion? Yes.
I'm sorry, Part A goes how far under the?
It goes down.
Page 3, line 10.
Yeah.
So that what would be left is section 6, the impoundment section.
Ask a question?
Yes. Gardner.
Page 2 under item 5, lines 17 through 20. If this is going to pass, I think we need to make some provision for the fact that if the defendant is driving a vehicle that is not his own.
Mr. Chairman, I am moving to delete the whole thing. So if my amendment passes, we don't have to reach your issue.
Okay.
And your issue, like I said, we could clarify, but it's already covered in law. So if it's not their vehicle, you can't forfeit the vehicle if it's not the person's vehicle. But anyway, no objections. Or, I mean, we have an objection. Would you? Any
I thought you know you'd objected.
I objected. Yeah.
You're still objecting?
Yeah.
Objecting to separating.
No. We separated the question. Okay. This is
right. Got it.
On deleting A.
Okay.
Which is
all the four.
Six. Everything yeah. before section.
Everything before section six.
Six.
Yep. Which is the forfeiture? Just for.
I have a question on the forfeiture, but that's later.
Well, maybe. Madam Chair, could you call the question? I mean, would you call the roll?
Representative Gatto?
Pass.
Representative Elkins, not present. Representative Lynn, not present. Representative Ramirez, not present. Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gatto?
No.
Chair Seaton?
No.
Excuse me?
No.
Thank you. One yay, three nay.
Representative Gardner, did you have a question?
I guess I feel, Mr. Chair, like I'd like to have some public testimony on this provision.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up last time.
As a general principle, Mr. Chair, I support taking a vehicle away from somebody who persists in using it without a license.
Thank you. Can we ask Representative Garo, you've looked at the amendment. Did you study it?
I did, Mr. Chair, and actually something just occurred to me. If I could offer just this as an idea for a compromise, but certainly your decision, the decision of all of you should go. It seems like if you leave in the impoundment, the new impoundment penalty in the amendment, but deleted the mandatory forfeiture, what you would have is a law that, if you look at page 2, lines 17 to 18, the court, it seems, has the discretion to order a forfeiture right now for driving without a license, and maybe that's the way it should be. In the more serious case, like the repeat offense, if it's appropriate and it was the car of the person who was driving it, give the court the discretion to order forfeiture like the law says now, and then have this mandatory impoundment provision that you have in Part 2, but not have mandatory forfeiture in all cases, because then you have the thorny issues of what if the car didn't belong to the person who was driving, what if the person who lent it to him didn't know, and I wonder...
Representative Gurr, I think that would have been the effect of Representative Grunberg's motion, and, you know, I would like to... rescind our action in that last motion and re-vote on motion on 3A. I think I will support removing the forfeiture, the mandatory forfeiture provision. And I think that's the effect of your of your motion. See, I'm trying to figure out if that's a proper route.
Where that is.
So, Representative Gardner.
So does this mean that If we agree to that and pass this, it means that the court can order forfeiture of the vehicle, right. And if they do not on a second offense, they have to order impoundment.
Well, the impoundment would take place if somebody was driving without their license.
We haven't gotten to that issue yet.
That's a separate issue.
That's Part B.
This is just Section 7A, which would leave the law the way it is, which you could take... forfeiture, but you don't. The courts don't have to. So I would ask for unanimous consent to rescind our action in failing to adopt amendment or the motion to drop 7A. Is there objection? No objection. Okay, so we've rescinded our motion on that, and now we're going to vote quickly on 7A.
I wish we could just hold this over until next time, because I think we might get maybe some more public testimony, and I'm up against a deadline.
Okay, I guess we're done, so we are going to... be done with this for the day. We'll be adjourned at 10:23.